Welcome back to another episode of Télévision Éducative. Tonight, I'll show you how dreams are prepared. People think it's a very simple and easy process, but it's a bit more complicated than that.
In an era where social media and video sharing platforms dominate the digital landscape, the reach and influence of these tech giants have become unprecedented. YouTube and Facebook have revolutionized the way we access information and connect with others, and they also shape our perspectives on the world. Welcome back to Breaking the Screen Spell, an Only in San Jose special that investigates and analyzes the impact of digital addiction and its prominence in society. My name is Dietra Huang, and I will be co-hosting with producer Alina Yin.
Okay, Dietra. So this conversation, what were your takeaways?
I found this interview really interesting. Dr. Zaitsev basically gave an inside view of what filter bubbles are, how they affect people, and the larger scale implications. One specific thing that I was especially interested in was how smaller alternative entertainment platforms are more likely than larger ones to drive users into a filter bubble. I sort of expected it to be the other way around and was surprised to hear that because the smaller alternatives cater to people who don't seek the mainstream experience, they're able to provide them a more nuanced palette of recommended videos. And I do have a question for you, and that is whether you yourself have been stuck in a sort of filter bubble.
I think so. I mean, when I look at my feed versus, for example, my parents' feed on Facebook is completely different. And part of that is we watch different news outlets. And so I definitely do not see the things that they're watching. But when I'm over at their house, I see it. And for me personally, I haven't been on TikTok long enough to really have, I think, the algorithm to get to know me, because I feel like my TikTok feed is not really that great yet. A lot of the things are not really relevant to me, but probably because I'm not using it enough, or I don't know what else could be up with that. But I think Dr. Zaitsev was talking about, when Dr. Zaitsev was talking about like cat videos, that was definitely me. I love cat videos. And so actually, you know, on my Instagram feeds, I get a lot of kitten videos and I love them.
I like the Christmas cat videos.
Oh, of them swatting down the tree ornaments?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are good. What do you think your filter bubbles are?
Oh, I'm not sure. Politically, I don't really have a filter bubble for that. But on TikTok, I do have a lot of tennis videos. And that's because I always send them to my friends in the tennis group chat. And I also send it to a couple other friends. But other than that, maybe cooking videos, even though I don't actually get to cooking them. I like watching them, though.
It's very satisfying, right?
Yeah.
I love those process videos. Sometimes I like to watch like those get ready with me videos of people getting ready in the morning and doing like, you know, their hair and makeup. And I don't know what it is about it, but it's like almost watching a puzzle piece being put together, and it's highly satisfying. Mm. Yeah, so I think another thing that really stuck out to me is when you were both talking about radicalization and how those filter bubbles kind of can drive an individual further down a rabbit hole that they themselves otherwise would have not voluntarily gone down. Have you ever felt like the algorithm was ever pushing you towards any particular rabbit hole?
I can see how the filter bubbles are probably a key issue that causes someone's political ideology to sway, but I don't find myself and my opinions changing along with the content that I'm viewing.
That's good. You got strong boundaries. All right, cool. Well, then let's get to it.
Today, we will be delving into the issue of indoctrination via social media, and the role that YouTube and Facebook have played in promoting political extremism. Social media platforms have a significant impact on the spread of information and ideas, and our topic today is particularly relevant given the growing concern about the spread of extremist ideologies through these platforms. Recent research has shed light on the YouTube recommendation algorithm and its potential impact on viewers of political content. The algorithm has been found to play a significant role in influencing viewers to consume more radical and extremist content, thereby contributing to the formation of what is known as a radical bubble, which is a subset of a filter bubble. This narrowing of perspectives can lead to an echo chamber effect, where individuals become further entrenched in their own ideologies and positions, and less likely to encounter diverse opinions. A study regarding algorithmic extremism written by Mark Ledwick and Anna Zaitsev was published in First Monday. Their results partially supported the claim that the YouTube recommendation algorithm influences viewers of radical content to watch more similar content than they would otherwise. The research findings indicate that users who initially engage with political extreme videos are more likely to receive recommendations for further radical content, leading to a reinforcement of their existing beliefs. Ultimately, the algorithm, by prioritizing engagement metrics, tends to prioritize content that elicits strong emotional responses, often associated with more extreme viewpoints. The implications of this phenomenon are significant, as it contributes to the polarization of public discourse and the perpetuation of ideological divides. By restricting exposure to diverse perspectives, the algorithmic recommendations can hinder constructive dialogue and critical thinking, reinforcing confirmation biases and potentially leading to the spread of misinformation or extremist views. Similarly, Facebook's recommendation tools have been linked to the rapid growth of extremist groups on its platforms. Facebook researchers themselves have acknowledged that the platform is pushing regular users down the path to radicalization. According to Mother Jones, a nonprofit American magazine, in 2016, The Wall Street Journal reported that Facebook researchers told executives that 64% of all extremist Facebook group joins are due to our recommendation tools. In response to the concerns raised by these alarming statistics, there has been a growing call for tech companies to take more responsibility for the content they promote and the potential consequences of their algorithms. This has sparked discussions about the ethical use of algorithms and the need for greater transparency and accountability in their design and implementation. For example, tech companies have made the effort to tweak their algorithms to reduce the spread of extremist content and misinformation. Specifically, going back to Facebook and YouTube, they have adjusted their algorithms to prioritize authoritative sources and trustworthy content over sensationalized or misleading material. By altering the criteria for content recommendation, they aim to limit the visibility of extremist content and improve the overall quality of information users receive. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter are currently attempting to minimize the spread of harmful content by employing a mix of human moderators and AI technologies to identify and address such content on their platforms. As users, it is critical to be aware of the potential biases and effects of recommendation algorithms. fact-checking information before sharing it can prevent the spread of misinformation and curb the influence of malicious actors seeking to promote extremist ideologies. We will now be speaking with one of the authors of the study mentioned earlier about algorithmic extremism. Dr. Anna Zaitsev is a researcher interested in social media, action design research, and software development methods. Her research collaboration on the algorithmic influence on social media has been widely discussed in the media and by online YouTube pundits. It has also influenced policymakers and academics. The results of the studies have been published on Open Access Journal First Monday, available for everyone to read. Welcome to our podcast, Dr. Zaitsev. So before we get started, can you speak a little bit about what made you interested in social media and algorithmic influence?
Right. So I was interested in this topic because I am a big user of a lot of social media. I was one of the early users, I would say, of Facebook. I'm old enough to have been there for a really long time. I wasn't one of the early users of Twitter, but I have been also on YouTube for quite a while. And I'm old enough also to remember the time before any of the social media and when the internet was slow and there wasn't that much to do on it. So, but since there became the explosion of different social media platforms, I've always been on the lookout to see what's going on and how are they affecting the world. And I wasn't actually doing social media research during my time as a PhD student, but afterwards I found a group of interesting people who had a great data gathering skills. And this is why I got really interested in studying the YouTube algorithmic influence as well.
That sounds really interesting, and it's great that you were able to form an interest in this. Your research and studies are super detailed, and the fact that they're publicly available attests to how important this topic is. Before we go any further, could you define what filter bubbles are and how platforms like Facebook and YouTube form them?
All right, so I think best way to do this is a given example of something that's kind of familiar to everybody. So let's say on YouTube, you're very interested in cat videos. And so YouTube will give you cat videos. And because of how the algorithm is currently set, it will keep on giving you cat videos in the what's next, like what to watch next feed on, usually on the right side of the screen. And so if you are interested in those and you keep on clicking them, the account learns that this is what you're interested in. So they will profile you as the cat video aficionado. And you will be kept in this cat video bubble because the algorithm is supposing that this is probably what you will be happy seeing. And it won't show you suddenly videos about ferrets or dogs or llamas or anything like that. So you will be given what the algorithm think you would like to see the most, because it can only guess so far into the advance. So it won't know if you suddenly become more interested in other topics. And so this will form you this cat video bubble. And to the same extent, it is a broader issue with different types of content. So it kind of, it's not necessarily very, very narrow like that. But let's say you are very into late night talk shows like John Oliver type stuff. So the algorithm will know that this is something you enjoy. And because it's kind of decided by the company that this is something that is safe to show people, because it is already on advertiser friendly platforms elsewhere as well, YouTube will never get into trouble by showing you these type of content. So you will be kept in that bubble for until you intentionally seek other types of content. And then those kind of preferences might be added to your profile, or they might not be added in terms of like what the type of content you were seeking. Because some of the content is not as widely suggested as other types of content is.
So I'm a little curious about how those filter bubbles have such a strong grasp on our attention. Once you enter the filter bubble, is there any way out other than willingly seeking out other kinds of material?
Well, it really depends on how strong the filter bubble effect is on any type of content. So in my research with my research group, we've done study on this on a political YouTube filter bubbles. And not all filter bubbles are at the same strength level. And so I can only speak from the political perspective here because I don't really know what it is for other types of entertainment content. And I think we must remember that majority of YouTube content is music videos, entertainment, gaming. So it's like this political stuff that I've been researching is a very niche area. But in the political case, there are stronger bubbles in terms of kind of more mainstream, either right or left-wing content, but you might see occasionally content that's coming from, let's say, the other side of political aisle. But if you go down into these more niche areas, then the filter bubble gets even weaker. The algorithm will try to direct you towards the mainstream version of the same thing. So let's say you're very interested in very niche right-wing politics, you're probably going to be suggested the more mainstream Fox News version of the same thing. So it really kind of depends on what your original starting point is and how the company has deemed what type of content is authoritative according to their perspective on how strong the bubbles are as well. And YouTube has many times said that they are preferring authoritative content, however they define that. Usually it is the content that's also like really pre-curated and clearly advertiser friendly, because it is a platform that relies on advertisement. Same goes with Facebook as well. They don't want to scare advertisers off by having content that's way too outlandish for them.
That definitely makes sense. Thank you for that explanation. Building on top of the idea of politicalization and filter bubbles, what would you say are the potential consequences and impacts of extremist content on these platforms?
Well, I think there are several theories about how this type of content will affect you. And the thing is, there has been, a long time, these discussions about how media or newspapers or books or television will corrupt the youth. Obviously, if you are being fed one type of thought over and over and over, it might have an effect on your way of thinking as well. And I think most people who are experts in the psychological areas relating to radicalization will probably suggest that you should not stick to any specific one type of political thought. But it's very hard to say if there is really a radicalizing effect. But again, there could be an effect that people who are already interested in that type of content will be more geared towards seeking it out, and they get validation for their ideas, which could further make them think that this type of thinking is the kind of right way of thinking. So, but it's really hard to know if it's the people seeking out the content or the content bubbling up to wherever the people are and people getting interested in it. Could be both ways. And it could be that the original seeking out the content trigger is coming from outside of whatever the social media platforms are, or it could be the other way around as well. So I think it's very, very hard to tell what the actual effect is. And I don't think there has been enough studies done in the radicalization of these platforms from that perspective.
That is true. I can kind of see how this might be a longer term kind of research topic to really see if there's any correlation between the two. Could you go over an overview of any filter bubble stats for youth and how it might affect their development?
Well, I think YouTube is geared towards younger people. Facebook, I don't think, not as much. Where I would be interested in how young people are getting stuck in filter bubbles is the TikTok platform. And I have not really researched TikTok, and I don't think there has been enough research on that at all. And I think that's an emerging phenomenon, which probably has some similar effects that whatever the other platforms are as well. I know that the platform's algorithm on TikTok is very addictive just by looking at how people are getting to look at that. But in terms of who is using these platforms, from YouTube's perspective, it's very hard to tell because you don't know who the actual users are. You don't know their age. You only know the kind of demographic breakdowns that YouTube tells that they have. So people who are watching the extremist content, they could be very young, but they could be also very old. But according to YouTube, it is kind of like a cross-section of all age demographics in US.
That's a good point. I found it really interesting how at one point you can start to lose your discernment of what your idea is about something just because of how it is suggested to you on those platforms. And with the prevalence of the topic of digital addiction and how social media's algorithms are made to be addictive, could you briefly go over what steps Facebook and YouTube have taken to address this issue of extremist content on their platforms?
Well, for YouTube, they've been quite open and clear about it. They have stated that they have a long list of things that are not allowed on the platform. They have stated that they're relying on the content creators who they think are authoritative. And they have expelled a lot of different channels who were on the very extremes from the platform already a while ago. I believe some of the most extreme channels were kind of deleted from the platform already like 2018-17-ish. So they have not been there for a while. There are alternative platforms though, which are still hosting all kinds of stuff, but I think that's another discussion and I haven't looked into those enough. From Facebook perspective, I think they also have a lot of different kinds of moderation efforts there. And I know a little bit about how it operates, but from Facebook, I think they have a bigger dilemma because of how the social media is set up. Because on Facebook, you're kind of supposed to see whatever your friends and family are posting, whereas in YouTube, you go and seek content from whoever the content creators are. So I think Facebook has to balance out how much do they want to restrict the content that your friends or family are saying versus how much do they want to kind of police what people are doing on their platforms. And because it is a platform where people share all kinds of ideas, if you have your kooky uncle who goes full flat earth, then you might want to see those things because that's your uncle. And Facebook banning those kind of things, they're kind of treading the line of, all right, so now we're worsening the user experience of these people because we're not letting them to interact with their friends and relatives. So I think they have all kinds of rules there as well, and things that are allowed to discuss and things that are not allowed to discuss. And I think they're pretty happy to ban groups of people where people are discussing things that they do not deem to be according to the terms of services. But I think it's kind of more open-ended of what their exact methods are. And they're not really that transparent about that either.
I see. So is there anything parents or Facebook users can do to protect themselves from going into an even deeper filter bubble?
I think if you are on YouTube, you can probably, you can use the incognito mode. You can have an anonymized account, which will give you the default recommendations. Then the default recommendations will be kind of more mainstream content, though. If you have your own account and you've already watched thousands of hours of certain type of political content, you're probably quite deep into that bubble. But you can always delete the recommendations. And then it will kind of reset anew and it will give you all different types of content. So there are ways of resetting the accounts that you have and what you're going to be recommended. But recommendations are not obviously the only thing that people are looking at. Like, you can go and seek for alternative political perspectives, or you can find channels that you think are kind of fairly balanced and will give you perspectives from all kinds of political positions. But there are ways of getting rid of the default recommendations by just kind of seeing what type of information all these platforms have on you. And I think there's on Facebook, there is a place as well where you can see what type of profile has been built on you. And that's kind of basis of the advertisement recommendations as well. And I think it's quite interesting if people will go and see what does the platform think they are like and what are they interested in.
That's pretty cool that you can reset that filter bubble. So that's one thing users could do. And building on top of this, what do you think are or should be the ethical responsibilities of the platforms in addressing the spread of extremist content?
Well, that's a tough question. Currently, there is, not to my knowledge, there might have been proposed many times all kinds of regulations on this. There is the I would have to look it up. What is the regulation? I keep forgetting its name, but there is a term that says that these are their platforms and not publishers, because publishers such as, let's say, magazines or TV channels, they are more tightly regulated, but platforms can host whatever they like. So there is a distinction made. I think it's 230 is the clause in the some kind of communications act. And so because of that, these platforms cannot be regulated. So it's basically up to them what they want to do and what type of like content moderation they want to have on their platform. And it seems like a lot of these platforms have kind of come to the conclusion that they have relatively similar standards. They will have moderation of violence, of nudity, some type of things that they would consider hate speech as well. And so there is this kind of confluence of rules that I think most large US-based platforms have agreed on. But then again, they also will have to balance out on how much people are willing to use their platform if they are being in some ways regulated and moderated. And there have been a lot of cases where people have been quite unhappy with the moderation. Like, for example, Instagram, which is a Facebook company product, there's been this, I would say, already quite long-standing hashtag, which has been on having the opportunity to have full frontal female nudity. So that has been banned for a long time, and people are not super happy about it. So they have the hashtag Free the Nipple campaign, which has been there, I don't know how, for how many years. And I think they're still not really, like all kinds of art pictures and stuff like that still gets censored all the time. So, but there's all these kind of campaigns against the moderation rules as well.
That makes sense, that there's that conflict of freedom of speech against harmful or inappropriate content. It is interesting that all the content on these platforms is up to the algorithms to be distributed to users, and moderators just ensure that the content is visually or legally appropriate. It makes me think about how some misinformation that travels around the platforms would only be stopped by another one of the users maybe calling them out on it. And going back to that idea of content moderation, have there been any historical events about the misuse of content moderation from social media platforms? And are there any topics that slipped that moderation system and found their way to the general public?
Not necessarily in that way. I think from the moderation perspective, there's been some interesting developments, not necessarily on YouTube, but from Facebook. They set up this Facebook Oversight Board, which is a committee of a lot of international, kind of long-term political actors who are acting as the Supreme Court of Facebook. And so they've been now since, I think they were set up in 2020-ish, they've been now sent fewer of these kind of decisions to make on the moderation decisions that Facebook has been making. And I think they were the ones that said that, for example, former President Trump should be let back on the platform after there was some kind of cooling period. So Facebook has kind of outsourced their biggest and toughest moderation decisions elsewhere. I don't know if any of the other platforms have been doing any kind of similar things, but that's one of the probably biggest moderation decisions that has been made in a couple of recent years, because I think most platforms deplatformed Trump after the January 6th Capitol riot. So, and that has also brought the moderation kind of at the forefront of discussion as well. And there has been a lot of scrutiny of the moderation. The people at the companies have been called in front of Congress to testify many, many times on all kinds of things. So it is a big issue, but I don't think there's any kind of clear resolutions on where that all is going.
I can see how politics can play a huge role on the direction of content. Moving on, I wanted to ask, as a researcher and based on what you found, do you have any thoughts on how companies should approach content recommendations?
I'm just happy that I don't have to decide these kind of things, because I think it's very, very difficult. And it's a very difficult balancing act, because they will want to have, because they are relying still on the advertisements on living, but they also want to have the users that are happy with them. Whatever they will do will make someone unhappy. And I think in the earlier days of the internet, these things were a little bit more simplified, but I think that was the time also where there was little less monetary incentives and there wasn't a lot of advertising ongoing. So I think when people harken back to the early Wild West of the internet, I think that the time of that was kind of more simple because not a lot of money was also related to any of these different actions. So now that there are monetary incentives of trying to keep people on the platforms and trying to engage them and trying to compete with other platforms for the same eyes, I think there is a fine balancing act that these companies will have to do. I don't really know what I would do if I would be the CEO of Facebook. I hope I never will have to find out.
That incentivization and competition really does drive how social media works today. Bringing it back to the idea of content moderation, how does that impact companies and the people that they provide their services to?
Well, for content moderation, I think that's another difficult topic. I've looked at this a little bit from terms of how the moderation has been set up, and a lot of it has been outsourced to all kinds of algorithms, which will make mistakes, but I think they are probably the better than the alternative, because I've done a tiny bit of studies into the human content moderators as well, and I wouldn't say that that's not a very nice job, because human content moderators of all social media platforms, the larger ones, they will have to see quite a horrible slew of all kinds of content. And it's an important job, but if that could be automated away, I think that would be something that I wouldn't stand against, because no one wants to see like horrible violence or animal or child abuse content just to make sure that the other users won't see that. From the other perspective, when people are getting their content moderated, if there's nothing that is really rubbing them the wrong way, they don't even know that that's happening. So it's completely seamless. They don't really know that some content is being pulled or algorithmically suppressed. It's only when something that they really care about get somehow moderated that people actually start caring about it. But like I would say probably 99% of all the content that's being moderated is something that people won't want to have on those platforms anyways.
That's true. Human moderators actually have access to that raw content, and some of it is really scary and just unthinkable. I also heard platforms use artificial intelligence filters to go through recommendations. Do you think that this is also an effective way to go through all of that content? Or would there be some of the drawbacks we see in human moderators applying to those AI filters?
Well, I think the thing with the AIs is that they're only as good as how well have they been trained. So whatever the training data that is being given to them, how accurately that is like labeled and how accurately, and this is just a quick primer on AI. So you have an AI, but if it's something that is, for example, seeking for cats, it will have to be shown a lot of different cats from different positions so that it will learn to identify what a cat is. And so if it has been shown a lot of different content, it will know what that content is, like as in kind of no, it will be able to tag and identify that. But the algorithm itself is not good or bad, really what type of rules are set within it. So it is still, I think, the responsibility of whoever the developers are on deciding what type of things they will like to highlight or downgrade in the recommendations. And then they can input those rules into whatever the algorithms are doing.
With all of the filter bubbles and content recommendations, how do they contribute to discrimination, hate speech, or targeted harassment of the general public?
I think that's a tough one because, again, it's really hard to know how much do these things that exist online have an impact on the outside world. They definitely will have an impact. But whether it is Facebook that's radicalizing people or if it's something like the message boards, it's really hard to know where the real culprits are. So I think probably a better way of looking at that would be seeing why people are getting so easily radicalized these days and what are the issues that drive them to discriminate or being hateful online. Because I don't think there's no one culprit to all of this. It's a more entangled web of people not feeling well and then taking it out on other people.
When talking about how easily people may be radicalized, what do you think are some of the main contributors to their susceptibility to all of the content and radical opinions?
Not being a psychologist, I think it's just people being young overall, and they are forming their thought patterns, and they are seeking out the ideas and kind of comparing them in their own minds. And I think that's the natural thing that young people do. They will experiment and they will figure out what do they think is the good way of going forward. And sometimes that can go awry. And I don't really know if there's much you can do about the youngness of people, unfortunately. Brain development is very difficult and takes a long time.
Definitely agree. Can you shed light on any potential unintended consequences or challenges that arise when platforms take a proactive stance against political content?
Well, I already alluded to these alternative platforms that exist. And so the more the mainstream platforms will, let's say, kick out some of the more extreme content, or they will make the more moderately perceived content creators from different political perspectives feel like they have been, not necessarily for real, but at least they have the perceived notion that they have been discriminated, they will seek other avenues. And I think the unintended consequence of that is that that could potentially silo the people more. So you will actually create the strong filter bubble effect that was maybe not as strong when everything was concentrated on a more major platform. So the more people just seek these alternatives, which will be less moderated and which will be less moderate, I think the platforms, by trying to maybe overly correct, might be actually creating some of these problems themselves. But again, this is also very hard to know how strong this effect is without really having a lot of studies that would also take these alternative platforms into account. But the thing is that it's very hard to also study the users of them because they are set up in the way that the users are even more anonymous than that what they would be in the kind of larger platforms.
So to my understanding, generally, there have been some issues and disagreements about content moderations and filter bubbles. How can companies ensure that legitimate free speech is not suppressed?
Well, that's another difficult one. I guess it comes to if you would be, so to say, free speech absolutist, then you probably would be only moderating anything that's related to like violence explicitly or, yeah, explicitly. But that's not really where the platforms live, because they also, it's not just that they go with whatever the Second Amendment says in the US, the First Amendment. Get my amendments mixed. But they also will have to go with whatever other countries have decided on these things. And so because they're globally operating, and so there is a push from other countries that have different types of legislation, even if US legislation is the most permissive, the thoughts on free speech and what type of content should be allowed varies country by country. So that's why these platforms will have to, again, do this kind of very balancing act where they will give enough leeway so that they don't upset the users too much, but still abide by the regulations from, let's say, the European countries or India or wherever they have big operations. I think Brazil has all kinds of legislation related to speech, and France and Germany definitely have. Whatever they're doing, it's not just kind of up to them or people in US to decide what is free speech and what does it mean. So that's another problem that these platforms have when they have to decide what are they going to be moderating. So in short, yes, they will probably suppress some stuff that would be free speech from one country's perspective, but is illegal from other countries' perspective.
So when talking about content moderation in other countries, are there any laws or policies that come to mind that should be implemented in the US?
I don't know enough about that. My legal knowledge is close to zero being in the tech field. So no, I don't think I can speak about that too confidently.
No problem. Just building on top of this theme of content moderation, where do you think the future of content moderation is going, whether it's artificial intelligence or by human moderators?
I think it's going to be automated more and more. I think these systems are getting pretty good. I think the natural language processing algorithms are getting better and better. And image recognition is also getting quite good. So I don't think the human moderation, at least not to the extent as it is, will be a thing in too long. So I think a lot of this stuff will be algorithmically moderated pretty quickly. And then it's still up to the platforms for themselves to decide what the rules are going to be for this. One thing which I am kind of looking with some concern is, will there be a lot of mistakes and will anyone notice those mistakes? Because a lot of the moderation is quite seamless. So if a lot of stuff is getting removed that shouldn't be, I don't know if there's a lot of recourse for those people who will get potentially censored if everything is done by machines. I think there's going to be a little bit less human accountability in that part. But it might be that also the machines are going to be more accurate. It's really hard to tell, but at this time, since we are kind of at the cusp of this phenomena.
That's a good point. I can see how technology might be playing a bigger and bigger role in the spread of information. Would there be any avenues for the public to stay informed or participate in the process of digitalization or moderation without being susceptible to rabbit holes of filter bubbles?
Well, I think it's useful for people to know about moderation. It's useful for them to kind of sometimes think about, like, what does it mean that I'm posting on a social media? That there are people who might get this post, they might take a look at it, they might decide if it's good or not. People have probably already encountered moderation when they've been using, like, copyrighted music, for example. We can't upload those. There's an algorithm that quickly takes it down. Otherwise, it's not very transparent on the company's behalf of what they're actually doing and who the moderators are. These are oftentimes outsourced to different vendor companies. So participating in that from the user perspective is probably limited to taking part maybe in these campaigns, where if you see that there is some kind of issue with the moderation, then trying to lobby the companies themselves or something like that. I recall hearing a story, and this is probably a little bit older one, but there was a breastfeeding group on Facebook that got censored for nudity. And I think they were quite angry about that. And then they raised a stink in media, and I think some of the groups were unbanned afterwards. So that is, I think, a valid avenue of trying to get the companies to do stuff, like just complain about them publicly enough. Because they will care about that. If the users are their business. So if you have enough people complaining, maybe something will happen.
I heard you mention some alternatives to mainstream media platforms. I was a little interested in what these platforms are and why they continue to be unknown by the majority of people. I wanted to ask, what are some of the features that are integrated in those alternative platforms that make them viable alternatives?
Well, most of the alternatives, let's say we have YouTube, but then we have also Rumble, and then we have, of the bigger ones, we have a platform called Odyssey. They're very similar. And what will make them viable alternatives, I think, is the ease of use. Because YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, they're very easy to use. There's no barriers to entry. And if you have a good user interface, and if you have enough content there as well, I think that's the other part. Like, if they will attract kind of what internet lingo would call the normie content, then they can become quite formidable alternatives. But before that, if there is only the niche content that is politically oriented, I don't think the big masses will be too interested in it. So it has to have the public wider appeal before they become more viable alternatives. But that being said, a lot of tech companies have gone under in a fairly quick succession. If we're thinking about MySpace or others like that, there has been a lot of social media platforms that have failed, and quite rapidly and quite unexpectedly as well. So who knows what's going to happen? I guess that's probably why TikTok is so popular. It has that kind of appeal to wider public, even though that might be a younger appeal, but it still has an appeal to a lot of users. They've gotten a lot of users in quite a short time.
I definitely think so too. I have TikTok, and I noticed that once you like videos, more similar content is going to show up on your For You page. And that's basically the TikTok version of an Instagram feed. Similarly, when my friends share videos with me, that also affects what shows up on that page. And sometimes the content is so similar that it's easy to pinpoint what video was shared with you that caused that exposure to content that you're unfamiliar with. Adding on to this, I also found what you said about YouTube and Odyssey having similar features really interesting. I was curious whether, even though they have these similarities, whether the content on each would be visibly different. For example, would it be easier to fall into filter bubbles on YouTube than it would be on Odyssey?
I think it would probably be the other way around. I think the more niche platforms, which have less moderation, will attract more extreme content. And I think a lot of the bigger ones, I would say Rumble is one of the big alternatives. They are actively seeking to have the mainstream appeal, whereas some of the smaller ones, not sure about Odyssey, but for example, BitChute, which is a small alternative platform, they're probably not really even looking for that mainstream appeal. So they're happy with whoever the content creators are who are there currently and who are, I would say that's also a more difficult platform to use. It's not kind of normie platform. So I think in that sense, if you only ever visit that platform, then you're probably going to be seeing more extreme content that you would ever see on the bigger and the more mainstream one.
That is very interesting, and that's a completely opposite answer than what I expected. If we look at the participants on each platform, do you have any tips for parents or adults using Facebook or other social media platforms to keep themselves away from filter bubbles or rabbit holes of radicalization?
I would say don't get stuck on the alternatives and stick to the big ones. But also, I would be cautious about the newer ones, such as TikTok, because there isn't, I think, as much oversight that there is on the kind of more established major platforms. But the problem is, it kind of really depends. Not all filter bubbles are bad in a sense. Like, you might be happy just looking at whatever content you're being suggested because you are interested in that type of content. So some of the filter bubbles are just probably good customer service. So it kind of really depends what you're seeking from your social media experience. Some of the people might want to stick to their bubble and some might intentionally seek alternatives. But I think that's up to the individual to decide, like, what are their political, how much do they want to engage with politics overall? And if they are in interested in that, how much do they want to venture outside their kind of political thought bubble that they've kind of already intentionally created to themselves, not intentionally but potentially unintentionally on their social media.
I wanted to extend on this topic a little bit more. When adults and parents are navigating these websites and potentially falling into those filter bubbles, to what extent does that affect their children or the people who live with them?
I would say that, well, first of all, most social media have an age limit of, I think it's 13. You're not even supposed to be on any platform. And I don't think kids should be engaging with this type of content. There's still a lot of stuff that kids will see on social media that I don't think is very helpful or healthy for them. And another thing is, if people are obsessed about social media and they're just kind of doom scrolling their filter bubble content and not engaging with their kids, I think that can definitely have detrimental effects. But I'm not a psychologist. This is just my kitchen psychology thinking on this.
All right, thank you. So wrapping up, is there anything that we haven't mentioned that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think what is oftentimes forgotten in these discussions is that these platforms, they are business driven. So they will have to make business decisions because they will want to continue living and gaining profit. And so a lot of the times people are blaming them for either not policing people enough or policing people too much. But a lot of these decisions are made because of potential business pressures that they have. So I don't know if that's something that is not as clear, but that is part of the decision-making of these companies. So when people are complaining about the companies themselves, I think that's just something that they will probably have to keep in mind, that it's not just up to the regulators or the users or whoever. It's also a lot to do with however the money is distributed, the advertisement money. And that is a big part of that. And the users are a big part of the funding and keeping the eyeballs on the platform ecosystem as well. So the users themselves are not, let's say, completely blameless, because they are the ones who are bringing revenue on the companies who are then reacting to whatever the advertisers want. So there is a cycle of influence that happens on these things.
Absolutely. So what would you say are some tips for the users who cycle through these social media platforms to keep themselves away from radical or toxic content?
Don't go on social media. Go outside. There's a lot of nice redwoods around San Francisco Bay Area. Well, right. I think overall limiting social media usage and exposure is probably not a bad idea. But again, this is from my own personal experience, nothing to do with any kind of research that I've done.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this interview with us. Your answers were great, and I really appreciate how you've dedicated time into your research and making it accessible. In conclusion, the prevalence of social media and the power of its recommendation algorithms have raised concerns about the potential for echo chambers and the amplification of radical content. The studies cited suggest that algorithmic amplification can lead to the formation of radical bubbles, limiting exposure to alternative views, and potentially contributing to the growth of extremist groups. It is crucial for users to be aware of the potential consequences of these algorithms, and for social media companies to take responsibility for addressing these issues. Wrapping up today's episode, I'd like to encourage you all to take another step towards digital independence. A fun activity could be to embark on a photo challenge. Choose a theme or topic this week and challenge yourself to capture interesting photos related to that theme using a traditional camera or just your phone's camera. You can create an album and share it or keep it. As Dr. Zaitsev mentioned just now, the Bay has some very beautiful redwood trees, and spending some time outside could do us all good. Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of our podcast.
Hi, I'm Rashmi, and I'll be leading you through a guided meditation today. So let's get started by simply finding a comfortable posture. This can be seated or lying down, whatever feels most comfortable to you. And as you've found your posture, starting to connect with the body and the breath, maybe bringing one hand to the heart and one hand to the belly, taking a nice deep inhale through the nose, feeling the belly rise, exhaling out of the mouth, taking another deep inhale through the nose, feeling the belly rise, full of air, exhaling out of the mouth, and taking another deep inhale on your own breath, maybe allowing the hands to float to the sides of your body, allowing your whole body to just relax here. Softening the shoulders and the jaw. as you're ready, maybe starting to imagine a gold light at the top of your head. And this gold light can represent any positive affirmation that you'd like to cultivate for yourself. It can be compassion or kindness. And whatever this positive affirmation or belief might be, imagining it culminating in that gold light at the top of your head, moving down your face, your neck and shoulders, down your chest and back, all the way down your belly and hips, all the way down your legs, moving through your feet, illuminating your entire body, taking a nice deep inhale here through the nose, feeling that positive affirmation illuminating your entire body. Taking a nice deep inhale through the nose, feeling the belly rise. Exhaling out of the nose or mouth. Feel free to come back to this practice at any time throughout your day.